Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereun, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, Brendan Bracken, the Irish-born adventurer who became Winston Churchill's greatest supporter, the 400-year fight to end slavery in the Americas, and to end the show, treasure and ghosts in London in the early 20th century and how one man blurred the line between scholarship and entertainment. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. And we begin tonight's show with Brendan Bracken. Brendan Bracken was born in Tipperary 125 years ago this month, and he went on to become a formidable publisher, Winston Churchill's closest political ally, and Minister for Information in Britain during the Second World War. Bracken helped manage Britain's message while shaping press power behind the scenes. The Little Museum of Dublin is restaging its wonderful exhibition on the life and legacy of Bracken in its renovated museum, and we're delighted to be joined by Charles Lycett, the eminent and very distinguished biographer of Brendan Bracken, who also wrote his entry for the Royal Irish Academy's Dictionary of Irish Biography. And Charles, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you, Patrick.
I think people will find the story of Brendan Bracken extraordinary, how someone from Tipperary reinvented himself so successfully, created so many accounts of his life, and ended up, you know, via a time in Australia, ended up becoming a Conservative MP and the closest ally of Winston Churchill. And at one point, Churchill said that he was sometimes his sole supporter in the years when he was striving to have his country properly defended. How did Bracken achieve all these things?
Well, extraordinary, you could say, force of personality. He had I think a very commanding personality, of course, played a part in the quick mind. But it's an exercise in self-invention of someone who reacted against, deserted his own background. But not strangely, his own mother. He remained utterly devoted to her, although he had transformed himself into an English Tory. He, as long as she lived until 1928... he remained devoted to her.
And there were all these different stories and myths about his background, wasn't there, that people believed different things and he told different versions of his history?
He had various versions. The one that never seemed to die, the rumour that never seemed to die, was that he was Churchill's son. And, of course, that was somewhat better in England than Temple Moore and the GAA. So he put up family photographs of the Churchills in his flat in Mayfair as if they were his own family.
And although Winston loved him, Winston's wife wasn't a fan.
Initially, that's true. But as the years went on, she wouldn't have... she was quite snobbish, really, Clementine Churchill, and she'd regarded him as a bit of a vulgarian and that type of thing. But as the years went on, he was so loyal and steadfast and ensured Churchill's political survival that she came round to him, and in a kind of cerebral way, but never the emotional attachment that her husband would have had to Bracken.
He had extraordinary connections, and I think his time involved in the media world helped him, because he took over the Illustrated Review in London in 1922. Then he renamed it, I think, English Life, and it opened him up to a whole network of people.
Yes, well, yes, the journalist world, which he made a tremendous impact. I mean, arguably, that rather than politics is his main life. He got in with a family, Aaron Spottiswood, they were the publishers of the Bible, and he took over a journal of theirs from Hilaire Belloc, and that led to his founding a magazine called The Banker. And that was the beginning of a stable of financial papers, which eventually included the Financial Times and the Financial News. And he deserves the credit, really, for bringing the modern Financial Times, still published for Bracken House. There's a bust of him in the hall of the place. It's a formidable memorial to him.
And at the same time, as you describe him as a ubiquitous socialite, he's and building up this career in publishing, he also gets involved in politics and becomes a Conservative MP.
Yes, quite young. He gets elected in a tremendous contest in North Paddington in 1929, when he was expected, the Tories were expected to lose the seat. The tide was against them, but he managed to hold on to it. And during that election campaign, he was accused of being a Polish Jew. And in order to counteract that, he had to produce his Irish birth certificate. But underneath his Irish birth certificate, they said, Mr. Bracken is British by birth and comes from long generations of British people.
And in the 1930s then, when Churchill was abandoned by so many in politics, Bracken stood by him, and Bracken was his closest ally and supporter when Churchill was being criticised over the party policy on India, on appeasement towards Germany. It was Bracken who was there, always backing up Churchill.
Yes. As he said later, we were a party of two, because Churchill was very isolated. India, he was backed by diehards, opposing more self-government from India. An interesting Tipperary link there is that he was being briefed by Sir Michael O'Dwyer, who was a Tipperary man who'd been Governor General of the Punjab in India. And he was briefing Bracken. So these two characters were trying to keep India for the British Empire. A long way from Tipperary, you could say.
So what happened then when the Second World War broke out? Because Churchill joins the cabinet, he becomes Prime Minister in 1940, and he has Bracken very close to him. He makes him his parliamentary private secretary.
Yes, well, Churchill, they had to bring him back into the government as First Lord of the Admiralty, 1939. And, of course, Bracken went with them as parliamentary private secretary. And then there was a period when a phony war, and the war was going badly. And in 1940, people turned against Chamberlain, and there was a question of who would succeed him. And Bracken was very important in the manoeuvring that led to his being appointed rather than Lord Halifax. And if that hadn't happened, Britain might have made a peace with Germany. That was a major contribution. And when Churchill became Prime Minister, Bracken, who wasn't married, of course, moved in to live in the bunker behind Downing Street. And if anyone goes to visit the Churchill bunker, you will see a room there, and Mr. Bracken is on the front of the room. So he was there, and people spoke of the men who met Churchill after midnight, how influential they were. And Churchill did say that Bracken, Beaverbrook and Smuts were the three people he relied on most during the war in conversations with them.
In July 1941, he was made Minister for Information.
Yes.
What did that ministry involve?
Well, it was propaganda to some extent. But Bracken's great contribution was keeping the press on side, a spin doctor, speaking to pressmen, especially Americans. He had a very good rapport with Americans, and that's one of his big contributions. He knew more about America than most people in British public life at that time, and he was important. He went with Churchill to the Quebec Conference, and at that time Roosevelt was standing for, was it a third term or something, and the feeling was he wouldn't be re-elected. And someone said, were the British government supporting Roosevelt? And Bracken's answer was, well, they weren't interfering in American politics,
Bracken had a wonderful turn of phrase, yeah. And indeed so did Churchill.
Yeah.
Do you think he ever helped Churchill with any of the speeches or any of the key public addresses?
No, I don't think so. Churchill wrote his own speeches, and there was a very distinctive role in Churchill's prose in the speeches. No, Bracken, I mean, he would have talked about the topics and, you know, that type of influence, but he wouldn't have written speeches.
Very good. And what about towards the end of the war then, when the Conservatives were defeated and Churchill was evicted from office? Some people blamed Bracken and they thought that his language was too extreme, that he was pressing Churchill to take these extreme positions. And some blamed him for contributing to the scale of the defeat.
Oh, yes. More Beaverbrook. Beaverbrook and Churchill felt that in the wake of the war, Britain needed to espouse free enterprise. To revive the economy and not follow this rigid state control which has existed during the war. And that contributed to the coalition government with Labour breaking up. And then Bracken gave one of the speeches at the 45 election, and it was quite hardline. They were blamed to some extent. And after the war, you see, the Conservatives moved to the centre, with people like Butler and Macmillan favouring that. They thought they would get back to power more easily by doing that. And Bracken was very much in opposition to that in the House of Commons in the early years after the war. But the other side won out, of course. But the Conservatives, Churchill was ambivalent about it because all he wanted was to get back into power. He wasn't too pushed by what economic policy was pursued as long as he could get back on the world stage. And of course, he was eventually re-elected in 1951 as Prime Minister. They defeated Labour, and everyone assumed Bracken, of course, would be in the cabinet, as he was in the 45, and he said no. He was offered the colonial office, and he said no, and he retired from politics, and he became Viscount Bracken of Christchurch, which was his constituency in Hampshire. He wouldn't have liked to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire. I don't think that would have appealed to him. But also, he hadn't very good health. He had very bad sinuses. But rather mysterious how he turned his back on a political career at that stage. But he concentrated on his newspapers, and the Financial Times went ahead, success to success, under a great editor called Gordon Newton. So,
and even though he was given that peerage, he never took his seat in the House of Lords.
No, he called it the morgue. He wasn't interested in it. He said he regretted taking the peerage.
And when Churchill had a stroke, he was central to covering it up and making sure that people didn't find out about it.
An extraordinary episode that Beaverbrook and himself, and they succeeded in gagging the whole British press, because I suppose there was tremendous goodwill towards Churchill as well, helped them to do it. But it was really an extraordinary episode.
And I can see why they had such a strong bond, because they were there in the trenches when no one else was backing them, when no one else was supporting them, when it was their darkest political days. So I could see how that would forge a bond that wouldn't break. But I wonder, did they ever fall out? Were there ever disagreements? Churchill had a very strong personality. Is there any examples or evidence of times when there was tension in the relationship?
Well, Macmillan said nothing but quarrels, arguing with one another. Said they argued incessantly with one another like a happily married couple. But, you know, whatever quarrels there were or disagreements, the friendship stuck. The loyalty was there, of course, the underlying loyalty.
And when he died, he had been always a heavy smoker, as you recount, in that he was diagnosed with cancer of the throat. And he died in 1958, and his papers afterwards were burnt by his chauffeur. Why do you think that was?
Well, there was a man he was very friendly with called Patrick Hennessy, who was a Cork man who was the head of Ford. And he was a close friend of his. Bracken died in his apartment in Park Lane. He gave the go-ahead to do that. I think he said that's what Brendan wanted. And he did that. He was much. Beaverbrook was very annoyed when he heard it had happened. But I don't know that a lot was lost. The thing about papers is your letters are in other people's papers, not in your own. When I wrote the biography, I found most wonderful letters that he had written in other people's to other people. Because the wonderful letters were the ones to his mother, who died in 1928, and which are featured in the Little Museum and were the basis of an exhibition there. And they're really very moving. He was so loyal and so attached to her. And despite the fact that he had gone off at 15 years of age to Australia, away from her, extraordinary study, those letters.
You mentioned when you said that he never got married, you said, of course. And I wondered, was there a certain emphasis you were putting on the of course?
Well, I suppose, yes. Well, that's, of course, all this world was undercover a bit in those days, but I don't know. I mean, some felt he might be homosexual, that's possible, but he certainly made efforts to marry two society ladies in the 1930s. One was the daughter of Lord Birkenhead, the great lawyer, and the other was the Penelope Dudley Ward, who became an actress. She became Lady Reed. Her mother had been the mistress of the Prince of Wales. And he always liked it to be thought that he hadn't married because she had turned him down. But she told me she'd never been asked. So, but he kept her photograph at his bedside. But I don't know what the full story is.
But I wonder, is there a sense that he's neglected in this country because he's not really claimed as an Irish person because he reinvented himself as this different persona?
Oh, yeah, he's been regarded as a terrible traitor. He lost the faith and ganged up with Churchill, whom a lot of Irish thought wrongly was very anti-Irish. So he was almost an unmentionable figure until, I think, these biographies appeared. But the way he had a revival, though, when Queen Elizabeth came to Ireland and when she visited Croke Park, the head of the GAA, a man called Cooney, said that he spoke of the fact how the founder of the GAA was the father of one of her ministers. And, of course, the interest, so the way he was rehabilitated. But Queen Elizabeth was the only person present who would have met him on that occasion. When Churchill became Prime Minister at 10 Downing Street, there was a great dinner, and she came to dine at 10 Downing Street. And she would have met him on that occasion.
So how do you think we should remember him in Ireland? What do you think his legacy is?
Well, the odd thing is he's remembered more in Ireland, perhaps even than in England now, because he epitomises the Irishman who wanted to become a Brit. But also there's a considerable achievement of Churchill and the Financial Times, and that has to be recognised.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure tonight talking to Charles Lycett, who's an author, a biographer, a barrister, talking about the life and legacy of Brendan Bracken on this, the 125th anniversary of his birth. And there's a wonderful exhibition in the Little Museum of Dublin. We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. For more than four centuries, enslaved people across the Western Hemisphere, from the United States and the Caribbean to Mexico and Brazil, fought any way they could to gain their freedom. A new book recovers their dramatic stories in one sweeping narrative, focusing on the thousands of acts of defiance that kept the flame of freedom alive. It vividly chronicles the resistance that eventually ended the slave trade and, with Brazil's abolition in 1888, the institution of slavery itself. The book is called The Great Resistance, The 400-Year Fight to End Slavery in the Americas. It's published in hardback by Basic Books. The author is Carrie Gibson. And Carrie, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
It's a wonderful study, but you take it from a different perspective. You know, normally we're used to accounts that look at maybe the laws or the institutions or the slave practices themselves. But you explore the story of slavery through the prism of resistance and how people fought against it and tried to overturn it at every stage.
Yes, that's right. And I think what we see when we look at it this way is kind of a very different story. We see how institutions failed, how there was reluctance to grant people full emancipation immediately. We kind of see the struggles in this within the system by the people who challenged it from below, the people who had the most to gain, obviously, their freedom. And so I wanted to kind of look through that lens because I thought it was an important one. It has been given more attention over the years, more recently, but it hasn't all come together. I wanted to bring it together kind of across the hemisphere in this book and get a sense of, you know, that the sort of epicness of this struggle, which really does, you know, spread out for more than 400 years.
And again, as you say, taking that global sweep with it, that it's the United States and it's South America. It's looking at Jamaica. It's looking at Haiti. It's looking at the wider hemisphere. And it's not just the story of slavery in the United States or slavery under the British Empire. This is the whole story.
That's right. And my background in academic research was in the Hispanic Caribbean. So I had spent a lot of years working on the Caribbean islands of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic, and kind of being familiar with a lot of the histories that were written in that area. Now, of course, slavery in the US is probably the best known because there's kind of been the most cultural production around it, right? I'm thinking of like Gone with the Wind or 12 Years a Slave, you know, Hollywood, movies and that sort of thing. So it's the one that kind of sits in the wider, certainly in the English speaking imagination, a little more, you know, vividly. And then of course there's the British involvement in the slave trade and in slavery in places like Jamaica. And what I was trying to do with this book is bring all these things together. And of course, bring in Brazil too, which is, you know, a whole other sphere. And kind of and put it as, you know, this kind of larger landscape of both enslavement but also resistance. I don't really focus too much on the horribleness of life under slavery, and I because I think a lot has been done on that. And instead, I really want to focus on the many ways that people tried to fight the system. And sometimes it was a personal fight, and sometimes it was you know, a bigger revolt. But also when you look at the different imperial nations that had slavery in the Americas, there are different means by which people could try to get their freedom. So for instance, in the Spanish and Portuguese systems, there were ways to buy your freedom. You could use the courts often against mistreatment. There were things that differed quite significantly from the English system, for instance. So again, this book is a place to kind of explore all those kind of many avenues.
And the resistance began at the very beginning. Resistance when the slavers were attempting to capture people in Africa. There was resistance on the Middle Passage, the journey over to the new lands where slaves did, enslaved people did resist, did fight. Some were executed and hanged for, thrown overboard. That you see a resistance and a fight against this from the very start.
Yes, and I think sometimes that is a little overlooked because the sort of the story of, say, the slave revolt in Saint-Domingue, which is today's Haiti, you know, was a huge kind of 13-year struggle, and, you know, and that's a big epic story in itself. But so sometimes it's overlooked that resistance was immediate. You know, people tried to run away in coastal Africa, you know, and certainly on board slave ships. One estimate is that about 10% of slave ships had revolts, and the number's probably higher. A lot of times either, you know, these things weren't necessarily recorded, or they were suppressed quickly, or, you know, a boat might have sank, you know, without record or knowledge of what happened. So 10% perhaps is a conservative estimate, but certainly, yes, the resistance against slavery was from the get-go. You know, it was immediate.
And what was driving this? Why was there such demand for an enslaved workforce for the production of sugar, for the production of cotton? What was driving it? How big were the financial rewards for those who were establishing these plantations?
There were many, many factors, and they changed over time as well. So, you know, you don't get cotton really until the 19th century, or the mid to late 19th century, you sort of get it 1830s, 40s, 50s, going into the US Civil War. Sugar you get much earlier on. But initially, the idea was to find gold. And of course, and this book looks very specifically at African slavery and not indigenous slavery, or attempts to enslave indigenous people by the Spanish, which kind of preceded it. And so there was this idea that, well, we can't, you know, either people died, especially the case in the Caribbean. A lot of Taino and indigenous people just, you know, died of disease or violence. And so there was a need to find a labor force to clear the fields, to go down the mines. It was a really wide range of work. And I think, again, because we sort of think of Gone with the Wind and cotton fields or sugarcane, but actually, you know, across this panorama, I mean, there was always domestic servitude, but there was ranching, there was mining. Sort of the religious, some religious orders had enslaved people. The crown, you know, the English crown, the Spanish crown, they had enslaved people, royal slaves. So it was actually a very broad range of things. Obviously, in some places, it becomes that mono agriculture like sugar. And a lot of it was speculative in some ways, because people could make great fortunes, but they could lose a lot of money. I came across one really shocking statistic kind of towards the end of slavery about people running slave ships from Africa to Cuba. And this is when this trade's been mostly banned everywhere else. And some ships made profits of over 100%. And I'm sure that happened, you know, between Liverpool, you know, ships that left Liverpool and then got involved in the triangular trade 100 years earlier. But it was a very risky enterprise in some ways, and incredibly profitable when it did pay out. And likewise with plantations, you know, on the eve of the Haitian Revolution, so we're looking at like 1780s in Saint-Domingue, today's Haiti, it was called the Jewel of the Caribbean because it grew, you know, produced so much sugar that nobody else could kind of really compete with it. And you know, enormous fortunes were made on that. And so, yeah, it was a system that, you know, required so much labor in so many places. But what's really striking about it as well is that, you know, 99% of the products were things that were not needed. You know, sugar is not necessary for survival, right? It wasn't, anything that humans needed to you know, further their existence. And you could say that as well with, sending people to mines to find gold. I mean, gold was important as a commodity, you know, as a commodity and for trade. But again, it was what we're seeing really, and this is part of the reason this period interests me so much, is that it is the beginnings of what we understand to be capitalism as well, you know, in terms of how labor is controlled, in terms of the products that are consumed. You know, a lot of this leads to where we are now. And I think that's also a very important thing to recognize.
And I think we also have to understand that there was a range of different types of resistance, that you had your slave revolts, but you also had different types of resistance where people were forming other types of communities. There was sabotage, there was poisonings, there was different ways that people found to try and resist this burden of slavery.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in some ways, I hope I captured enough in the book, because it was so diverse and often quite creative. But one of the most striking things is probably what is known as marinage, which was, you know, self-emancipation. People ran away and they formed communities, often in quite remote places, you know, away from officials. And in certain places, this definitely happens in the Spanish Empire. It happens with the British. In the Spanish Empire, it happens in many places. But one of them that I write about in the book is in Colombia, called San Basilio de Palenque, and they form these communities, and the Spanish cannot suppress them. You know, they fight them. They can't get people back into slavery, so they end up having to kind of do deals with them and say, okay, you can stay here. And usually the deals involved having to capture other runaways and promising to return them, you know. But you know, it kind of speaks to the power of these groups, because if you think about it as well, a lot of them were, certainly in the 1600s, were, you know, people who had come from Africa. This was a completely new landscape, and they managed to figure out a way to survive in a completely unknown land, you know, and keep the officials at bay and not be returned to slavery. And it happens in Jamaica as well, quite famously, with the Maroon communities there, who end up again making deals with the British because they can't be suppressed. And so the story of Maroon communities is one of the most, I think, fascinating ones that I kind of got to research in the course of doing this book. But also, I mean, yeah, there's a wide range of kind of, I guess what I would call maybe more everyday things like poisonings, sabotage, you know, working slow. And then sometimes there was what they called petit marinage, as in like short breaks. People would leave and they would maybe go to a neighboring plantation and visit a loved one or something and come back. And they were kind of allowed to do this within a certain remit. So they could kind of carve out small times of autonomy for themselves, even, you know, under this larger world that they had to live in of enslavement.
So taking that perspective of slavery across the hemisphere, why did it come to an end then? Was it because the levels of resistance just made, you know, brought it to a crushing stop? Or was it the fact that a changing mood meant that for too many people it was unacceptable and they weren't prepared to put up with it? Or was it a combination of factors?
It was absolutely a combination of factors. And it changes over time. I mean, one thing that was a great boon was the growth in the printed word. And, you know, people were reading more and more about this. And when you started to get actual narratives from people who had been enslaved, that was a very powerful, thing for the reading public. But you have it in different stages and it plays out in different ways across. I mean, and that's the kind of great joy of working on this area, is you can kind of see like how these things evolved differently, but also together. There was always the pressure from below. I would argue that, for instance, in the case of the British Empire, you had an increasingly interested segment of the public. And then from below, you had a number of slave revolts in the 19th century. You had Barbados in 1816, Demerara, which is today's Guyana, in 1823. And then the Baptist revolt in Jamaica, which was at the end of 1831 and went into 1832. And it just became clear that this was untenable. And the system, you know, had to be changed. Now, in the French story, it plays out very, very differently, because you have the French Revolution and you have certain ideas about liberty and equality crossing the Atlantic and taking their own form and informing how the slave revolt in Haiti went. But what happens with the French is that you get the independence of Haiti in 1804, but in 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte basically reinstituted slavery everywhere else. Haiti managed to fight off France and thus became independent and free. But the French brought slavery back in, and they didn't re-abolish it until 1848. So, you know, I wouldn't say there was one particular model that kind of played out. It really was contingent on so many circumstances. But I think certainly by the 1830s and 40s, and definitely after 1848, which is when France re-abolishes it, Denmark does as well. The sort of end is nearing for the Dutch Empire, although they don't technically do it till the 1860s. But it really becomes clear that you know, the system of slavery, it can't really stand for that much longer. But then, of course, it still does until the 1880s in Brazil and Cuba. So it is an uneven process. And I guess that's one of the things that the book can really make clear, because it doesn't end with the U.S. Civil War. And I think a lot of times, again, that's sort of an idea that's a bit large, like, oh, by 1860, it was kind of over. And it's like, no. There was still quite a lot of slavery, you know, especially in Brazil. At that point.
So the story goes up a lot longer until 1888. And you see the legacy and the legacies of slavery all around us. Do you think the gun culture in the United States is another of those legacies?
Oh, definitely. It was really striking how related that is. And really, there's a kind of a culture of violence throughout the Americas. I mean, the United States has a particular gun problem, but other places in the Americas do have problems with gun crime as well, and violence, and things that I would say are very much related to the legacy of slavery. But one thing really comes to mind, which was the Denmark Vesey conspiracy revolt in Charleston in 1822. And after that, the city created or kind of boosted its militia. And today there's a military school there called the Citadel, and the roots of the Citadel were from the boosting up of the local sort of armed men, because there was such a kind of, serious slave conspiracy that really spooked the city, basically. And so, and that's just kind of one example. But, slave revolts and the idea of a slave revolt was a fear throughout the entire Americas. You couldn't keep people in bondage without a culture of violence. I mean, that was part of the system. And so understanding that and trying to grapple with the aftermaths of slavery, like we're still in that moment because there's still an enormous amount of violence, in the world, but certainly in the Americas, very specifically.
Well, it's a wonderful new book about the 400-year fight to end slavery in the Americas. It's published in hardback by Basic Books. The author is Carrie Gibson. The title, The Great Resistance. And Carrie, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. June 1912. A pair of workmen deposit a heavy ball of clay in the antiques shop of George Fabian Lawrence, or Stony Jack as he's better known. As Lawrence picks through the mud, a speck of gold catches his eye. A pearl earring tumbles into his hand, then another. A Burmese ruby follows, then Colombian emeralds, and then lots more. Stony Jack has discovered the greatest single cache of Elizabethan treasure, and a new book tells this extraordinary story. It's called Stony Jack and the Lost Jewels of Cheapside, Treasure and Ghosts in the London Clay. It's published in hardback by One World Publishing. The author is Victoria Shepherd. And Victoria, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's a fascinating story. And first of all, I'm going to start almost towards the end, where Queen Mary seems to have been obsessed by this treasure and was very interested in the whole thing. And even in later years, when Stony Jack died, she was very interested in the auction and what was going to be coming up for sale.
Yes, Queen May of Tech, as she was known, and she has a reputation as something of a kleptomaniac, which I've managed to stand up as part of the book. But she fell under the spell of the Cheapside hoard very early on in 1912, when she just recently become queen. She loved jewellery, famously, sort of went to get her own family jewels. She'd go and kind of retain them, go take ferry trips to go and get a jewellery that had gone astray through marriages from her own family. And she loved this collection of jewellery. And part of the research in the book, one of the most interesting aspects of it from my point of view, is how the different levels of society all became captivated by the jewellery, from the largely Irish navigational engineers who found the treasure in the first place in June 1912, right up to the royal family, who she was part of the London Museum, who exhibited the treasures first of all. We know that she took some of the neck chains herself, because she gifted them back in the 1920s to the V&A. So she literally had her hand in the treasure chest. But I do think, like so many people, rich and poor alike were captivated both by the kind of beauty and bling of the collection, but also by the currency of superstition that I identify in my book, that the semi-precious stones, the rings, that it was a jeweller's stock in trade that had been found. And so there are very blingy items encrusted with emeralds, and there's an emerald, single emerald cut into a watch case, and so on and so forth. But there are lots and lots of finger rings with semi-precious stones that all had kind of symbolic meaning for protection, kind of amulets. And the Queen was very interested in the meaning of gemstones, and like we all are, I suppose. And that's one of the things I love most about writing and researching about this collection, is that we all kind of understand the power of jewellery and its value beyond just its financial meaning and wearing. It's spoken to when people lose an engagement ring or inherit a piece from their grandmother. It doesn't have to be super valuable, but the idea of semi-precious jewels and rings, of which there are hundreds in the Cheapside hoard, and the kind of their protection and their symbolic meaning. And I think Queen Mary was as into that as anybody else, and really coveted the jewels. She had a private view before they were exhibited to the
public. Tell us about the collection, but also tell us about George Fabian Lawrence, or Stony Jack as he's better known, because he seems to be a remarkable combination of antiques dealer, middleman, showman and entrepreneur, and he was a great one at maybe spinning a great story around things as well, creating an excitement around them.
Oh, absolutely. He's a fascinating and very strange character, because on the outside, well, he's the son of a pawnbroker from the East End. So he came from very humble beginnings, but he knew about trading objects through his work with his father in the pawnbroker's shop. And then he became a mudlark in Victorian London and found things in the mud and clay in the river. And on the outs, he ran this little shop that was this incredible. I wish, Time Machine could take me back to it now. It's now a nail bar in South London. But it was this kind of old curiosity shop, to use a kind of Dickensian phrase, stuffed with treasures that he'd found, bits from Egypt and so on. And he had a kind of, people reported him as having a sort of clairvoyant attitude to the objects that he found. He really believed that, a leather shoe that he'd found, Elizabethan shoe that was found in one of the rivers of London, that he could kind of communicate with the person who'd worn it, or a Roman sandal or whatever. And yet, and his day job, so that was his Saturday job, was running this shop. But he was he was this kind of epitome of Edwardian respectability, in a kind of three-piece suit and horn-rimmed spectacles and Macassar hair, oiled hair, and really the essence of a kind of respectable museum man. And he was acquisitions for the British Museum and for the London Museum, where, grandees who ran the business used him to acquire objects for the collection. The British Museum, most of its star pieces of the Roman collection were brought by George Fabian Lawrence. So we had a kind of secret life going on. And he would, his stroke of genius, and the reason why we have the Cheapside hoard, was that he realised if he went to building sites, there's a building boom going on in 1912, if he went to the building sites, and he taught the labourers what to look for when they were digging down for the first time through the virgin clay of, Georgian, Victorian, down to Roman London, then they would spirit them off if they found something. He taught them what to look for, and they would bring these objects secretly to his shop on Saturday. And he would pay them. They trusted him. He was very honourable. So if they brought him junk, he would still give them a beer. And he would split the money if it was valuable. And of course, it's unconscionable conflict of interest now that you'd be buying and selling to the British Museum at the same time. But this was a period before provenance, before anyone really took detail or was expected to keep detailed records. And so he had this brilliant idea, and it paid off. And then this one, amazing day and June the 12th, 1912, that they brought this sack, what they could describe as an iron football, because it's London clay, full of jewels, and they washed it in his shop, and out fell the Cheapside hoard. So it was his dogged, slightly roguish, he always walked just the right side, sometimes stepped over the line of legality, because he would be in the land of the City of London, and treasure trove rules were very strict about who owned what, and he didn't care at all. But thanks to him, we need to thank him for so many treasures. But the Cheapside hoard is chief among them.
And you really see the extent of the British Empire and the global trading networks of the earlier Elizabethan time, in the fact that you have jewels from Brazil, emeralds from Colombia, you have stuff from India and from Bohemia and Hungary, and you have pearls from Bahrain and Afghanistan, like Burma. There's stuff from all around the world here, treasures and so many remarkable items.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what it tells us. I mean, the Edwardians were in the middle of this huge love affair with the Elizabethan age. They had lots of sort of comic operas, and Sir Walter Raleigh and Elizabeth I were sort of very much in vogue. And I see it as that, they were really interested in, because society was really cracking under all sorts of strikes and inequality. Titanic had just sunk, and the Elizabethan age to them represented a sort of golden age of the beginnings of this enormous expansive empire, where we really did, we were going all around the world and collecting these amazing jewels. And it really does open up this history of what was happening, the Elizabethan empire, and how they were, often these jewels would get to Holland or Netherlands, to be traded. That was this kind of centre of the jewel trade. And then lots of them would come to London. It was a very international scene in London too. Lots of the gem workers working under the noses of the guild, because you had to be a member of the guild to be allowed to work. But there were people from all over Europe, Italians, Dutch, working just outside the city boundaries and sharing skills on how to cut these stones, and the traders coming in and out. It must have been very busy and very exciting. And they would literally share techniques on how to cut the rubies or the diamonds or the stones that came in via Holland, usually from, as you say, from all over the world. And this gives the hoard is, you know, these objects are beautiful, but they do give you this insight into the breadth of the empire. And also these, you know, Europeans in London, all working together in the 1500s and before, in a way which certainly for me I found fascinating. I don't think it's a story that many people would necessarily know. It teaches you about it, or it gives you a way into thinking about how the empire and these kind of international trade, really, the beginnings of that, the mechanics of that through these beautiful objects.
And a huge mythology around the beautiful objects as well, and ideas that there were ghosts that were haunting them, and when some of them ended up in the gold room, stories in the newspapers about how there were ghosts walking around, and that there were all these mysteries and clues and things that had to be investigated. And I suppose that added to the huge public fascination and interest then, because there was so much interest and hysteria about what was connected to them.
Yes, and, you know, the big Tudor question that all of the Edwardians were immediately obsessed with, but we still are now. I think I've solved some of, you know, elements of it. But who buried these treasures in the first place? When and why did they not come back for them? A hoard, to be a hoard, I love this definition, to be a hoard, it has to have the intention to return to the buried objects. Otherwise, it's just treasure trove. And so people wondering why, who'd done it and why they hadn't come back for them. And the ghost, there's a wonderful file, which I managed to get my hands on for the book, account from a psychic that ended up in a drawer in the Museum of London. Supposedly, a psychic in 1948 who'd spoken to this ghost, who said he was following these jewels around because he'd made bad luck charms as well as good luck charms, and he needed to track them. But yes, the story of this ghost, the kind of central casting Tudor man, the quote unquote original owner of the jewels, haunting, following the treasures around whenever they were exhibited, it's the same person. He crops up from the very first time they're exhibited in 1914. Right up till later exhibitions, and there are accounts of, you know, people fainting and looking at this, sort of having a vision of this man saying, "What, you know, why do you have my treasures and I want them back," and so on. And so this kind of this Tudor ghost haunting the Edwardians is a really big element of it. And I think you can read it as a sort of, I don't know, people were beginning to say, well, or there was the beginnings at this time of wondering about objects and how come the British Empire, how come we'd acquired all these objects from around the world, and did we have the right to them? You know, issues that we still wrestle with now about what's in the British Museum and so on. And I kind of see the ghost as the beginnings of people wondering about how much they deserve, you know, about the rights to own objects that have come from, have been acquired from all over the world. But they are delicious stories, and these accounts of this man in doublet and hose, who gets angrier and angrier every time he appears, demanding his jewelry back. And I think people did love we all love a mystery, we all love a treasure hunt, but the ghost became a really common, a thread throughout it, of people sort of, the mystique, the wonderful mystique of going to visit these jewels right from the first time that they were exhibited, and the frisson of mystery and of the symbolism, because nobody could quite work out why they were buried, why no one came back for them, and what they meant. And of course, in those, you know, in the Edwardian period, even then, we were beginning to lose the vocabulary of these superstitions that each kind of semi-precious stone would mean. And back in the 1500s and 1600s, people would really have known very directly what a sard or a jasper or an amethyst symbolized, and that kind of language of superstition and symbolism is really delicious to go back to. I've certainly loved sort of getting reacquainted with what semi-precious stones, not the most valuable stones, the precious, you know, the precious gems, but the semi-precious stones and the kind of the language of superstition that they have. And of course, the Edwardians would have known that a little bit in a kind of inherited from your grandmother, maybe. And I think that that nostalgia for that kind of superstition was there. And it's still here now, I think. If you really look at the objects, you can have access to that. And it's a lovely communication with people in the past, I think.
And although Lawrence Stoney Jack did get some money for this treasure trove, and it was probably a reasonable sum of money in the day, it wasn't an exceptional amount of money.
No, and I mean, I genuinely don't think it was about the money for him. I've really dug around because, you know, he did get some money and it's all quite shady. You know, there weren't many records kept and there was a lot of fighting about who would get to control this hoard, who would own it. And Lord Harcourt sort of stole it essentially off the guild hall in the city. I genuinely think that for him, these objects, even these beautiful objects, and he loved becoming famous through them. And he was very good at the PR of, he was constantly talking about the ghosts and the ghosts that that haunted the jewels and that in fact had first appeared in his flat in Wandsworth in South London, the night that the jewels arrived. It was the first, his account of him and his daughter, who was also working as a psychic, as a spiritualist upstairs in his, secretly, of course, because the museum world wouldn't have found that a respectable thing at all. But supposedly he gave reports in the papers of this first encounter when they were sitting staring at this pile of jewellery and treasures that the navvies had brought to him, the labourers had brought to him. And the ghost is, that's when the ghost first appears in his front room. So he loved the kind of the mythology and the stories around it. But when he died, he had some money, but he never moved out of the shop. He lived above the shop, this curiosity shop in Wandsworth. I don't think it was about the money. And so I do genuinely think that he had this, as I say, a sort of clairvoyant attitude. Everybody who met him and all the accounts that we read all say the same thing, that he really did commune through these objects with the people who'd owned them in the past. And he sort of lived as comfortably in other centuries. He sort of slipped between centuries very easily. And he left some money, but he, as I say, he never moved. And he died. He was buried in a pauper's grave, is still unmarked, partly probably because he died just before the Second World War and events may have overtaken commemorating him. But, you know, he didn't leave any serious amounts of money, and the objects and the history and the communication with the past was what it was all about for him.
Well, it's a wonderful new study. It's called Stoney Jack and the Lost Jewels of Cheapside, Treasure and Ghosts in the London Clay, published in hardback by One World Publishing and the author, Victoria Shepherd. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, for putting everything together, and to my two wonderful transition year students, Cy from Cloister Isagon and Frank from Mount Temple. We hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been Talking History. Good night.